Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Our first annual Seed and Start Fair called Free the Seeds is Saturday, March 19th at Flathead Valley Community College from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. We'll have 18 workshops, 30 booths, 2 films, lots of kids' activities, 2 roundtable discussions on food resiliency for our community, and lots of seeds and starts for sharing and swapping. Come one, come all. For more information, check out freetheseedsmt.com or check us out on Facebook. You can also call 406-471-0022. It's going to be a great time.
Welcome to the show today. I am so excited because this morning, first thing, I got an email from a member of my audience who said he's been listening, and he heard in my recent episode with Liz Krieg, we were talking about organic lawn care, and I mentioned it would be nice if someone started like a certification for landscapers so they could teach their customers. Because probably the biggest lesson I've learned since I started this podcast is how toxic people's lawns are. And that's where toddlers are playing and learning to crawl, and dogs and cats are playing. And so I have been, and John Moore from Australia, the organic gardener, the Organic World News, who started his own podcast, you might want to check out. We had talked about organic golf courses. And so I was super excited because this listener sent me a link to the Dirt Doctor down in Texas who has a radio show. And if you've really been listening back in episode 39, Angie Schneider from the Schneider Peeps answered her question, who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques? And one of the things she said was the Dirt Doctor in Fort Worth, Texas, had a radio show on Saturday mornings who specializes in Texas growing. His name's Howard Garrett. And that's where we learned the most in the beginning. And she also answered the question, how do you learn how to garden organically? From reading his books, his book, The Texas Bug Book, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, she said was very helpful to her. And so I reached out to Howard. And here he is already. 2 hours later, we're talking, and we're going to tell you about his new book about organic lawn care and his certification program, if you're interested, which is coming up. So excited to have you on the show today. Welcome, Howard.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Jackie. Thank you.
Yeah. So go ahead and tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Well, I started in the golf course business and landscape business a long time ago after getting out of Texas Tech and then the Marine Corps back in 1972. It is when it all got started. I actually started my radio show and the column in the Dallas Morning News, both about organic gardening in 1989. So we've been doing it all since then. Back in the day when we started, I didn't know anything about organic gardening at all. My daughter, Logan, who also became the announcer on my show when she was in the second grade, and she still is, was the reason I converted over. I saw her do what all kids do, pick up things and put them in her mouth when she was 9 months old. And sorry about that.
No worries. I love my phone.
Now it's turned off. And she was the reason that I started looking into it. When I started looking into organic gardening, I had no idea what the term even meant. So I started from a base zero, learned the basics from people that did organic vegetable gardening and some agricultural type things, and I converted those ideas over to landscaping, and then I read everything I could get my hands on and everything and developed my own techniques. And the fascinating part of it was how easy it was. Landscaping organically is a whole lot easier than the farming and gardening because you've got so much more tolerance. If you foul up when you're raising food crops, you lose your crop and lose your money. In landscaping, you just kind of dust yourself off and fix things and go on. It doesn't mean you can't do gardening and farming and ranching organically. You can, but it's just easier to do the landscaping. And it's fascinating that there's not more people around the country and around the world doing it.
Not only that, everybody has a lawn. Not everybody has a lawn, but like way more people have lawns than gardens. And I'm just flabbergasted when like people say something, I'll be like, oh, I have no idea what my landscaper does. And like, I grew up with a mom who like, there were no chemicals going on her lawn. And, you know, she just like naturally did that, but.
Well, it's a paradigm problem. Most people, like you say, do what everybody else is doing. So people that hire a contractor to come in and tell them to maintain, get a price for mowing and edging and fertilizing, you're right. They don't normally ask what they're using. In the Dallas-Fort Worth area and all of Texas, we really have gone a long way toward organics. Of course, my mission is to convert the world to organics. We've got a lot of work to do, but in Texas, we have an advantage because I'm on the radio in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and a friend of mine, Bob Webster, is on in San Antonio, and John Dromgoole's on in Austin. And so we cover quite a bit of the state with organic gardening talk shows. And now my radio show is syndicated across the country. We're in about 210 markets. Mike McGrath is covering the Pennsylvania area and several states with his NPR organic gardening program. And then people like you are doing what you're doing with the podcast and the internet kinds of things. And it's really growing, and it's growing because the natural organic program works better in every way. It's not just that it's a way to stay away from toxic materials. That's part of it. It's an important part of it. But the most important part is that it simply works better. We can show people how to save 40 to 50% on their water bill, for example. Just one small reason why it's worth doing the organic approach.
Awesome. And you know who else, now that I'm thinking about it, episode 50, Dave Salmon, talked about that when he started his nursery, he was in New Mexico. This, he went the organic way because he wanted his customers to be successful, and he found that even after just graduating from horticultural school, that the organic way was just the best way to go. And then he liked to educate the people who worked at his nursery that way, because they then they could help his customers more too. And that's kind of just how he built his client base, because it was the most cost efficient and most effective way for them to have a nice landscape, especially in their, water. They had a lot of drought climate.
Well, one of the first things that I did here in Dallas was to help one of the largest landscape companies and one of the most famous landscape companies in the country convert to an organic program, Lambert Landscape Company. And they still today are 100% organic. And a lot of their customers, and they do extremely high-end residential landscaping, a lot of their customers probably don't even know they do organics. They just do it. It's just, their policy. Some people, on the other hand, hire them specifically because they do the organic approach. And we've got more and more companies getting into it. There's a dozen or two companies from small to medium size in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that are totally organic now, and then several scattered across the state. You won't find that many around the rest of the United States, but it's starting to happen a little bit here and there.
I know. So I'm so excited, because maybe it'll inspire some people to start a business like that. So, Howard, I do kind of always kind of like to ask at the beginning of the show if you would tell us about your very first gardening experience. Were you a little kid? Were you an adult? Like, what was your first gardening, landscaping, yard experience?
Oh, I don't even remember. I'm from an agricultural family. My granddad and my uncle were in the sweet potato business, and watermelons and peaches and things like that. So my first experience with plants was back when I was a kid and working on some of those farms, and I didn't have any interest in it at all. It was just something that I had to do back in those days. I really didn't get interested in gardening at all until I was in a junior at Texas Tech, and I had changed my major twice, from advertising art to business and then to horticulture and landscape architecture, because I took a horticulture course kind of accidentally. It sounded like it would be easier than chemistry. And so I took it, and part of that course was a lab where we designed a residential landscape. And I, you know, caught on to it real quickly and really enjoyed it, and ended up doing the project for two or three other people in the class in addition to mine. And talked to the head of the department and converted, you know, over to my degree program being landscape architecture and park administration. And that's how I got into it. So that was really my first experience really in gardening, other than just having to work in the fields loading sweet potatoes or something back in Pittsburgh, Texas when I was a kid.
Awesome. I love that for so many reasons, because I always tell my kids, are like kids that I meet that don't want to go to college, because they're like, well, I don't know what I want to study, that, you know, you just don't always know in the beginning. And you'll, like, all of a sudden somebody sitting next to you will be like, my cousin's sister's niece, you should meet them because they're like you and they do this super obscure job you've never even heard of. And the next thing you know, you're taking a class here and you just learn about things. And you also kind of learn some things about what I do not want to do while you're at it. And just, I think, you know, you meet people that you would normally meet. And anyway, what a great story on how you got to where you are now. So do you want to tell us a little bit about, like, what organic landscaping or earth-friendly landscaping means to you?
Well, it's very simple. We try to teach people that you stop doing two things. They're very important. And then you start doing basically one new thing. What the two things you stop doing are using synthetic fertilizers. The high nitrogen synthetic fertilizers are salts, and they're very destructive for the soil. They're very inefficient. They're not good in, really in any way. And that's the first thing. And the most important thing that we tell people is that you need to stop using synthetic fertilizers. Second thing we tell them to stop is to stop using the toxic chemical pesticides. A lot of people think that because I put it in that order, fertilizers being the most important and pesticides second, that I'm not that concerned about the pesticides, but I am. I think they're extremely damaging and dangerous and bad for our health and bad for the environment and everything else. Plus, they aren't necessary. We have, well, first of all, with the organic program, you reduce the pressure from insects and diseases tremendously, because you have healthy soil and you have healthy plants, and those plants have a natural resistance to the insects and the diseases. But when pests do pop up, which they're going to, because we're always pushing the envelope a little bit, we're always trying to grow something that's not perfectly well adapted, or, you know, we make a mistake or whatever. And so in every case, whether it's fungal diseases or bacterial diseases or even viral diseases, and then insects, we have organic techniques for controlling those pests that, you know, are non-toxic ways to go. And that's the program. As far as what you stop, is you stop doing those two things. But what you start doing is building the soil, building the health of the soil. And you do that with compost, with organic fertilizers, with rock minerals, and with sugars, especially on the front end of projects, because it speeds up the process. It helps to move the soil the direction that we want to go. And where we're trying to push the soil to is to be biologically active, healthy, with living organisms that are supposed to be there, just the opposite of what the synthetic fertilizers and the pesticides do. So that's the program. We stop doing two things, fertilizers and pesticides. We start building, using products that build the carbon, build the organic matter, build the microorganisms in the soil, build the health of the soil. And then if you do those simple things, all the rest of it's pretty easy, pretty much a piece of cake.
Awesome. That's perfect. So how did you learn how to grow that way and landscape that way?
Well, like I said, I saw my daughter putting things in her mouth when she was 9 months old, and I started looking into organic gardening. I had heard the term, but I didn't know what it was. And I looked into it. The thing that's different about me, and it started in college, is that I just never totally went along with the crowd. I was always asking questions and thinking about things from a little bit different standpoint. So looking at this natural organic approach is something that the first question I ever asked was to a PhD friend of mine who was an extension person at A&M, and I asked him about organic gardening, and he said, "Oh, forget that. It's ridiculous. It doesn't work. There's no possible way you can ever use enough organic matter to build the soil enough to do any good. It's not cost effective," and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's the storyline that all the university people used at that point in time. Unfortunately, still a great percentage of them still have that attitude. There are some university people, though, that have gotten into organics and have been a very important part of my education. Even some people have made the conversion over. But to get into organics, you have to be able to go out on your own. You have to take responsibility for yourself. And a lot of people don't do that. I've written columns, and they're on my website on dirtdoctor.com about what organophobia is, which is the term I give to those people who say that it won't work and say that the chemical way of going is okay. And the things that create organophobia, there's about five of them. One is that people don't understand organics. So they tend to stick with what they're comfortable with, what they've been taught in school, what they know how to do, what their peers are doing and all that kind of thing, because they don't know how to answer the questions and don't know how to do it. The second thing is there is a kind of a fear of going alone, of taking that responsibility yourself, like I mentioned. If you go organic, for example, around here, you can't blame your peers or some university or somebody else. You have to take the responsibility yourself or blame the dirt doctor, you know, one of the two. So that's a cause of organophobia. Another cause of organophobia is money. Some people make their living off of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides. You know, the university people get a lot of research grant money from the Monsantos of the world and the Scotts of the world and, you know, the Orthos and all that. And that's understandable. I mean, it's very difficult to get people to understand going a different route if it affects their pocketbook. Another cause of organophobia is just the paradigm, you know, being unable to see that it's even an option. You know, when you're stuck in a certain paradigm, you don't have the ability to even consider anything else. That's a big deal. I think the most important reason for organophobia is I think of all is the inability people have of saying that I'm wrong, that I've been wrong, I made a mistake, and there's a better way to go than what I've learned and what I've been teaching and saying and everything. I've never had that problem. I've changed. In the landscape architecture business, I often would design preliminary plans and then change it four or five times. It would drive the people working for me crazy a lot of times. But I was always looking for a little bit different approach, a different way to go, a way to make it better. So that's a big hang up for a lot of people. The problem that people have is that they've learned a certain technique at their university from the peers, from their instructors that they, you know, thought hung the moon. And it's very difficult for them to take the step of saying, all that stuff is wrong. I've learned a better way to go, and here it is. And especially when it's somebody like me that's been telling folks that the chemical approach is bad and people ought to stop doing it. You know, there's a there's a real difficulty in people buying into that in a lot of cases when they're so immersed in the way I'm saying that they should get away from.
Yeah, I could see that, I guess. And we're all kind of like that a little bit. You know, if we think something's a certain way, it takes a while. Change always is difficult. So do you want to tell us about something that either kind of grew well this year or something that, you know, consistently grows well, or a way for people to like incorporate organic natural landscaping into their yard?
A couple of the most famous plants that are involved in my organic program are here in my own garden. One is a ginkgo tree. And the ginkgo tree was planted back in, 30 years ago, back when my daughter Logan was born in 1985-ish. She, was at that same time when she was crawling around picking up things and putting them in her mouth. I planted a ginkgo tree as I was going organic. And the ginkgo tree at that point was 8 feet tall, about an inch and a half caliper, I guess. Today, it's competing for the champion ginkgo tree in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And has grown to be a very, very large tree. And ginkgo trees have the reputation, rightly so, of being very slow growing. But mine's not. Mine puts on anywhere from 12 inches of new growth a year to, in a couple of years, some of the new growth was 18 to 20 inches in length. So it has grown very fast. It's an extremely large plant now. We've got photographs and videos and stories about it on my website on dirtdoctor.com. My philosophy about why it has done so well is that it has been in two things. One is that it's been in an organic program from day one and been growing in healthy soil. And two is that I did something to the tree that I recommend everybody do to their trees, and that is that I dramatically exposed the base of the tree, the flare. The trunk flare, or some people call it the root flare, is the part that flares out and horizontally, and you, if exposed properly, is a very dramatic part of the tree, and you can even step on the flare growing out laterally from the trunk. It is part of the trunk. And we teach people to do that on all kinds of trees, ornamental trees, trees in pots, fruit trees, and shade trees as well. And the combination of those two things, I think, is the reason the ginkgo has done so well. Ginkgo is it is one of the most ancient trees on earth. It was around, you know, when the dinosaurs were here, and it probably is more important for it to be in organic, biologically healthy soil than for other trees, you know, oaks and maples and various kinds of things, and especially hybrids. Although we've found that this trunk flare exposure helps all trees. The other plant that I've got that has really taught a lesson for everybody is a bay tree. It's the Cooking Bay, Lars Nobilis, and it is a probably the largest bay in Texas. It may be one of the largest ones in this zone. We're in zone 8. But the people that push chemicals, the chemical way of doing things, try to teach people and say it over and over again, that bay is not hardy outside in the winter here in this zone, and that you've got to keep it in pots, move it in, and protect it, and that sort of thing. Well, my bay started out as a little 6-inch pot, and I moved it up to a clay pot that was 12 inches in diameter, I guess, for a while. I kept stepping it up for a while and finally put it in the ground. And it has now been outside in Dallas, Texas for 35 years. And we've had some extremely cold winters during that period of time. And the lesson that that teaches is that under an organic program, we see that the plants have about a full hardiness zone, more cold tolerance. And that's a big deal, you know, for vegetable gardening, herb gardening, and landscaping as well. We see that we, by going organic, we give plants a 4 to 5 degree protection of winter hardiness. So that, along with some of the other techniques that we use, really help us grow a wider range of plants.
Okay, so I totally agree with that. For one thing, you know, I think that's a big part of what Rodale said, is that, you know, when they did their test farms, you know, the conventional way might have produced in the beginning better, but only when you had the extreme ideal conditions, but that the organic outproduced it every time when the conditions were less than ideal. And so there's your cold hardiness is one of those non-ideal conditions for a plant. And then my other question I just have to ask, so like when you say a bay plant, do you mean like a plant that grows a bay leaf, like that you use in
soup? Yeah, it's like the bay leaf that you cook with. It's that plant.
Awesome.
Now, a lot of people think it's, you know, a lot more tender than it is. And the other thing you said something that I don't agree with. And I've seen Rodale say that before, and a lot of other organic people do too. And it's that thought process that the organic program doesn't work as well right at first, and that you have to be patient, and it takes a while for it to finally work and all that. I don't agree with that at all. And one of the main things we've done in our research, and we've got a nonprofit organization called the Texas Organic Research Center, and a lot of the data, hardcore data from other people and work that we've done is there in that website, texasorganicresearchcenter.org. And it's who is presenting the certification course that we'll talk about later. Okay. But we don't believe that it's slower and you can't have good production in the first year. The secret is you got to know what you're doing, and you got to know how to use the techniques that we've come up with on the front end to have that production the first year. And the secret to it is to use into the native soil. Native soil, we think, is very important. A lot of people think that you need to build raised beds and have all new material, or take out the existing soil and bring in new fresh soil. We don't agree with that at all either. We think that the native soil is a very important part of the bed preparation, and that we even like to inoculate potting soils with just a little bit of the native soil to give the native microorganisms. But if you use compost and organic fertilizers and the rock minerals, primarily volcanic rock minerals like lava sand and basalt and granite and zeolite and things that I recommend, along with sugars, primarily molasses and sugars that have a lot of trace minerals and everything, if you blend those into the soil in the beginning, you can have good production just like using synthetic fertilizers and everything the very first year. They are right that production gets even better than that long term, and the soil gets better and better and better with each application. One of the great cost savings with the organic program is that you never have the conversation that the chemical people have that goes something like this: well, that bed is worn out, so now we need to pull all that material out and put in new fresh stuff. That's a conversation that never comes up with organic gardening. The soil gets better and better and better with every application forever. And that's a giant cost savings.
Yep, I agree. I'm not sure what I said at this point, but what I was thinking was more like that you have to keep adding more chemicals as you go along.
Well, it's a common
way that you
it's
have
not
to keep,
just something that Rodell said. It's something that a lot of people say in organics is that it doesn't work well on the front end. And that's just something that I like to make a big point of. It will work well on the front end if you do it right.
Yeah. No, I think so too. Is there something you're excited to try next year or want to try different or something new?
Oh, we're always looking at new ideas and thinking about what could work even better. One of the things that I do that's probably very unusual is that I love to get tips and advice from my listeners and my readers. Some of my competitors that are especially the chemical pushers, they don't want to hear from anybody else about any ideas. But some of the things that I recommend that are the coolest things came from a tip from a listener. For example, I was recommending cornmeal for a long time, whole ground cornmeal, as a disease control and a disease cure in the soil for plants. And one of my listeners called one day and said that he had tried all that and it worked great, but he and his wife had come up with a new idea for use of cornmeal. And they said that they had had toenail fungus forever. And they heard me talking about solving fungus problems on plants. And they thought, well, toenail fungus is a fungus. Wonder if it'd work on that. They made a warm slurry out of cornmeal, soaked their feet in it, and cured toenail fungus. Well, from that, we had farmers and ranchers and all kinds of people try it on various other fungal issues, all kinds of plant issues and all kinds of animal issues and pet issues and livestock and everything else, and just kept coming up with more and more ways that cornmeal functions to cure fungal diseases. So that's been kind of a fun thing. Athlete's foot, came along as a recommendation. We've got people that work out in the field every day, and wear boots. And they reported to us that they didn't want to go to the trouble of making a slurry, liquid kind of thing. So they just took a little bit of dry cornmeal and tossed it into their boot and their sock, when they went to work in the morning, totally eliminated toenail fungus and athlete's foot. So it's really kind of fun to see what else will come out of some of the things that we've recommended before when somebody has a closely related recommendation. One of the most interesting things about cornmeal is that it was taught to me by the fellow that 25 years ago ran the research station, Texas A&M Research Station in Stephenville, Texas. And they had discovered it serendipitously by watching their research in their fields, research on peanuts. They noticed that when a corn planting followed the peanut planting on the experimental farm, that they didn't have the fungus called Rhizoctonia be a problem on their peanuts. And so when they told me that, I took that information and started applying it to other fungal diseases. I realized that brown patch and St. Augustine grass was also the fungal disease called Rhizoctonia. And so we tried it on that, and lo and behold, it worked great. And so we recommended it for that and started recommending it for other diseases in turf, like gray leaf spot and various other things that pop up. And lo and behold, cornmeal works on most all funguses, and it works by stimulating a beneficial microbe called Trichoderma. Trichoderma is a fungus, but it's a fungus that functions as a beneficial, and it will override the pathogens and take them out. And so you control the disease without putting out something that kills at all. It simply stimulates a good guy, beneficial microbe, and that beneficial microbe overrides the pathogens in the soil. That's why the chemical fungicides don't work. And you know, one of the reasons we don't recommend them. First of all, they're extremely toxic, and people don't realize how dangerous they are. Daconil, Captan, Balaton, you know, those kind of things that are recommended by the chemical boys all the time. But they don't work because they're indiscriminate. They kill the beneficial microorganisms as well or better than they kill the pathogens. Well, when you do that, you create this sort of semi-vacuum, and what grows back first? Well, the pathogens do. So you end up with creating a situation where the pathogens are a bigger problem than they were to begin with. And that's one of the great advantages of the organic program, is that you're not creating a worse problem. You're really solving problems.
I like that. So do you want to tell us a little bit about your book now and how that kind of works and what kind of things you suggest to people?
Well, I've got a bunch of books. I've written about 15 books. For a long time, they all had the word Texas in them, and that has kept people, as I've expanded my teaching across the country and in other countries, has held it back a little bit. But the truth is that all my books are pretty much applicable to any gardener, farmer, or rancher, coast to coast and border to border, if you adjust two things. One is timing. When you do things, obviously that varies from, you know, the northern part of the United States to the south. And if you adjust certain specific plants, well, obviously we grow different things in Oregon than we do in New York and Texas. But how you prepare beds properly, how you plant a plant properly, especially trees, how you do pruning properly, how you control diseases and insects, how you do composting. That's all the same anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world, for that matter, you know, with just those few minor changes. The last book that I did, last two books, are the two that are the least regionalized, the organic management for the professional, which has a bad title too, because it's not just for professionals. It's just it goes into things in more detail, and a lot of homeowners want that just as much as professionals. And then the last book is the organic lawn care book, and we cover grass techniques, planting and management for the summer grasses in the south, Bermuda grass, St. Augustine and zoysia, and also the northern grasses like fescue and bluegrass and things like that.
Okay. Are you going to tell us more details about like what's in them, what people will learn? Or?
Well, it's just the basic program in all the books. And then all my books go into a little bit more detail and different situations and give backgrounds about, you know, if we say we don't recommend a certain thing like glyphosate or like a synthetic fertilizer or something, we give great detail about why we don't recommend those products. The glyphosate is the one pesticide that's the most ubiquitous. Its use is not only across the board out there, but its use is growing, except with, you know, the organic people, of course. And it's such a brilliantly marketed product. It was marketed to be this product that's almost as safe as water, and it breaks down as soon as it hits the soil. It doesn't last. It doesn't affect animals, because animals don't have the pathway in the body for the glyphosate to damage. Well, the truth is, mammals don't have the pathway, but guess what? The bacteria in the gut of wildlife, livestock, pets, and animals does have that pathway. The bacteria do have that pathway. And that's why glyphosate is so incredibly dangerous. It's hurting the gut of all life, and the health of animals is directly dependent on the health of the gut. That's where all the health issues, you know, originate. And we now know, and there's data continuing to build and build, and we've got it documented in the Texas Organic Research Center website as well as dirtdoctor.com. The data is built, continuing to build, showing this direct relationship between glyphosate, which is Roundup, and degenerative diseases, including cancer, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and up to and including autism in kids, which really should scare people the most.
Yeah. My episode number 9 was with Dr. Stephanie Seneff from MIT, who talked about dangers of Roundup. And that was kind of one of the first places I learned about it on this show. And then, you know, several people have talked about it. And it just, like I said, you know, I grew up where my mom just was like, no way, we're going to have that stuff on the lawn.
Yeah.
But I know she gets frustrated with neighbors, and I know other people who live all around who just don't really realize. So that's why I'm so glad you're on today. And then, you know, I also had this guest from Missoula, David Schmetterling, who talked about natural plants and the water thing. So do you want to talk about how it helps lower your water bill by planting native plants in your area? And there's even like native plant websites, right? Where you can like government organ or like, I don't know, somehow. But anyway, do you want to tell us a little bit about how it saves water?
Native plants are very, very important, but it doesn't, no matter what kind of plant you're planting, if you're planting the most exotic things in that you could come up with, the organic program saves 40 to 50% on the water, because it creates a situation in the soil where the soil holds water at just the right level for a longer period of time. The way that happens is that when you build beneficial bacteria and fungi and protozoa and the beneficial nematodes and all the things that should be in the soil, the soil actually changes character completely. It changes structure because of the glues that are formed by the microbes and the pore structure and all that. It changes color, it changes fragrance, and it changes the ease with which, you know, it can be worked. So even though soil that's made healthy by organic techniques breathes better and drains really well, it, on the other hand, will hold that just right amount of moisture for a much longer period of time. The other thing that goes on in the water savings is that a beneficial fungus grows on the roots of most plants. It's called mycorrhizal fungus, or mycorrhizae. And this mycorrhizae, in what it actually does is create much, much bigger and healthier root systems that can access water more efficiently from a greater distance, and also access trace minerals from the soil better and be able to bring them into the plant. So all of those things working together creates a situation where you just simply don't have to water as often. It was proven for us first by a project that I helped convert to organics down in Houston. I had spoken to fundraising events for the River Oaks Garden Club for 2 or 3 years. They had gotten intrigued with the idea, and a lot of them had converted their residential properties, and they asked me if we could do it on a commercial basis. And my answer was sure. I'd done it on large commercial corporate headquarters, multi-hundred acres and golf courses and all kinds of big properties, and no reason not to. Well, they said, could we do it at Bayou Bend? Well, Bayou Bend is Ima Hogg's old estate. It's part of the Houston Museum system. And it's 8 acres or something like that. Beautiful formal gardens. I said, sure, no problem at all. And so they instructed the curator to go organic. Well, he fought it. He thought it was a bad idea. He said, it's a formal garden. It's very famous, and we can't afford to take a chance on insects or diseases taking things out. Plus, you can't do formal garden with organic techniques. And they said, well, I didn't know it until at this point, the River Oaks Garden Club women own the place. So they said, well, we're going organic as of today. So he had to do it. They forced him to do it. And he continued to be negative about it. He said he thought that he was going to prove to them that it didn't work. So he had kept records about what it cost for fertilizer and for pesticides and for water in the past. It took him only a year to become a big fan of organics because he saw in just a year's time that his cost for fertilizers and pesticides, because he had a reduction in pest problems, went, say, basically the same, but what went down by 50% was the water bill. Well, since that time, we've proven it on golf course projects and other projects as well. And across the board, whether it's small gardens or multi-thousand acre ranches, you can see that kind of reduction directly related to the health, the biological activity in the soil, and specifically mycorrhizal fungus growing on the roots of plants.
I love that. I wish so many golf courses would, because they're always like, no, we can't do that. No, we can't do that. No, the green won't be perfect. And that just drives me crazy.
Well, the reason for that, I deal with them all the time. The country club I'm a member of doesn't do organics. They don't believe a thing I say. And the paradigm is so powerful there because those superintendents do what they learned in school, what they have learned to do themselves, and what A&M and the USGA say to do, because that takes the monkey off of their shoulder. It puts it on the system. That way, if they lose their greens, which they all do with the synthetic approach, they can say, well, I've done everything technology has to offer. It's not my fault. If they went the organic route, like I was telling you earlier, they have to take the responsibility themselves. There are a few golf courses that are doing organic techniques or some version of it. There's very few, if any, that are doing 100% program because the paradigm out there is so incredibly powerful, and the money is all on the side of the synthetic fertilizers and pesticides.
Okay. Do you want to share with us? Do you want to tell us about your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there something you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
No, I don't know what that would be. I really like doing all the gardening myself as much as possible, especially trimming trees. I guess the one thing that I don't do, and I bring other people in to do for sure, is any tree pruning way up in the trees. I'm 68 years old now, so I don't like climbing around in high places anymore. But I enjoy doing the pruning myself. I have very specific techniques and philosophy about design. I think that a lot of tree pruning is overdone. Too many lower limbs are cut off plants and shouldn't be, and a lot of trees are thinned out too much. There's a misconception that trees need to be thinned on an annual basis to be healthy, and that's nonsense. If the trees didn't want all that foliage, they wouldn't grow it. So we try to teach people that there's pruning that needs to be done where their limbs are rubbing and causing problems or blocking a view or bashing into the house or the car on the driveway or something. But those are all things that are for your benefit, not the tree's benefit. If there's too much weight growing in one direction on a tree, that's a reason for the tree to prune the tree. But most pruning is done for our benefit rather than for the tree's benefit. So we try to get people to limit the tree pruning as much as possible. And we try to teach them about the fact that one of the worst things that's done besides over pruning is pruning too close, doing flush cuts that don't preserve the branch collar, cause cavities to develop in trees, rot and cavities. And so we try to get people to think about pruning at the right spot and preserving that branch collar, like happens when a limb falls off of a tree naturally in the forest. If you look at where it broke away, it leaves a little bit of a stub. That stub is the branch collar. It's part of the trunk. It's not part of the limb. And that's why it's so important to cut outside of that branch collar.
Oh, okay. There's a great tip. So on the flip side, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden then? Or the yard?
I like helping people save trees, getting the bases of the trees uncovered. We learned about the technique from other people, and now we're teaching others, and we actually do seminars showing them how to use the commercial device to take soil and mulch off of the flares of trees. It's called an air spade. It looks like a sandblasting machine, but it only puts out air at a high velocity, no sand or anything else. And you can expose the flare without hurting the tree tissue and expose circling and girdling roots that are damaging and cut those away, remove those, and to cut off the bird's nest roots that are growing up trying to get up to oxygen. We also teach people how to remove the soil from the base of trees with hand tools, being very, very careful. And one of the tools that's the best that I show folks how to use is a horse brush. You know, it has real stiff bristles.
Yeah.
And you can brush the soil away. It needs to have a little moisture in the soil, not too much, not to be sopping wet, but moist. And you can brush the soil away from the bases of trees and expose that flare. We have really good photographs on dirtdoctor.com in the library and in other places. We've done a lot of newsletters on it showing trees that are too deep in the ground, trees that are exposed properly, and how you do all that. By the way, people, any of your listeners can get our newsletter. It's free, and it got a lot of people that are already taking it, but anybody can get it by simply signing up on the form there on the homepage of dirtdoctor.com. It's a weekly newsletter.
All right. Well, good for you. That's a hard thing to do. Cool. Okay. Because we have some fruit trees that we planted recently. Maybe that'll help them a little. What's the best gardening advice
fruit
you
trees.
Have ever received? Or go ahead. Fruit trees.
Fruit trees, by the way, tend to be the most abused as far as being planted too deep in the ground. People tend to think that the graft union, you know, where there's a little swelling or a dog leg, people tend to think that's the part that ought to be about right at ground grade for some reason. And if you plant a tree at that height, you will have planted it about 8 to 10 inches too deep in the ground.
Oh, really? Okay.
Most of the problems people ask me about with fruit trees can be directly solved by uncovering the base of the tree, uncovering the flare, because almost all of them have been planted too deep in the ground. I had to expose every tree on my own property that I planted myself, because years ago I was cavalier about it and not careful about the height I planted trees, and I ended up planting most of my own trees too deep in the ground. And I've exposed them, and once you expose them the very first growing season, you can almost hear them sigh this sigh of relief and start growing better and producing better. And if they're flowering trees, they flower better. If they're fruiting trees, they fruit better. And the disease and insect problems drop like a rock by simply doing the exposure. Now, the base exposure is step one of a procedure that I recommend all the time that's called the sick tree treatment. We came up with the sick tree treatment as a way to solve red tip phytinias that were dying all over the United States, especially in the South, of course. And they were dying because they were inbred with a problem. They were inbred being susceptible to a root fungal disease. Well, we came up with this idea of doing a souped up version of the organic program. We called it the sick tree treatment. And what it is step one, remove the soil from the base. In other words, uncover the flare, most important part. Step two, aerating the root zone of the plant. And on a big shrub like Photinia or a tree, as you know, the root system grows out 3, 4 to 5 times wider than the drip line of the tree. So in most cases, to aerate the root zone of a woody plant, you're going to aerate the whole property. You know, stick holes in the ground, pull plugs. A liquid way of aerifying is to put out, to spray hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide from the grocery store. Dilute it with water, 50-50, spray it out on the root zone. That is an oxidizing way, just same way it kills the bacteria when you cut your hand, does the same thing on the soil. It stimulates, it kills right at first, and then it starts to flocculate the soil. It starts to cause this fluffiness to the soil, which gives an aerating effect. You don't do it over and over again. You do it one time. And then the rest of the sick tree treatment is to apply the amendments, same amendments that we use for bed preparation, compost, rock powders, and the sugars. And then we mulch with shredded native tree trimmings, my favorite mulch. And then we spray the plant, the final step of the sick tree treatment. We spray the plant, the stem, the trunk, the limbs, the ground plane, with the mixture that we call Garrett juice. And Garrett juice is compost tea, vinegar, molasses, and seaweed. The formula is in my books. It's on the website, or you can buy commercial products if you don't like making your own. That's the sick tree treatment.
So the molasses goes in with the sick tree treatment mixture?
It's part of Garrett juice. Garrett juice mixture is compost tea, liquid molasses, seaweed, liquid seaweed, and apple cider vinegar. And the apple cider vinegar is one of the things that a lot of organic gardeners leave out of their liquid spray program. And I think it's maybe the most important ingredient in the whole formula, in the whole mix.
Okay. I never heard of that stuff. Sounds good, though. What is the best gardening advice you've ever received?
To go organic.
Cool. I like that. Be
open-minded. One of my friends from the past who wrote the foreword to my book, Landscape Design Texas Style, which is one of the few books of mine that's not even in print anymore. We're going to redo it at some point, but right now the only way you can get it is from, used book places, and you can still find it. But the foreword was written for me by Stanley Marcus, and the thing that Stanley taught me more than anything was to be open-minded and continue to learn new things all the time. Listen to people, read, and not be closed-minded. And I think that's the best advice I ever got. And it's probably the best advice I can give out.
Cool. I like that. Well, we should have in mind like an open parachute, right? I don't know, something like that. There's a thing. Do you have a favorite tool? Like if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what would you take with you?
Oh, the Air Spade, is a commercial product and it's hard to beat. It's fantastic. There's also one called the Air Knife that's a similar device that does just different manufacturer. As far as my own hand tools, one that is probably... Well, two. There's two. One is called the stirrup hoe or the push-pull hoe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got a metal device on the end of a regular wooden handle that moves. It looks like a shape like a stirrup on a saddle, but it swivels just a little bit, and you do a push-pull action, and it is the most efficient way to weed gardens, especially when the weeds are fairly small and just getting started, of any device I've ever seen. And everybody ought to have one of those. The other thing is a probe, and a probe is important, especially for organic gardeners, because one of the tenets of the program is to water properly, you know, and water only when needed, not overwater. And to determine when to water is something you can't set up on a schedule. You've got to determine it yourself. It varies on every site, depending on the soil and the slope and the sun or shade and the type of soil it is and all that kind of stuff. So to determine what the soil is doing moisture-wise, you probe it. You stick a probe into the soil. Well, there's three probes that I recommend. One is a commercial product called a pipe probe, and there's photographs and information about it in the library, on my website, if you want to see what it looks like. But it's a fiberglass. It has a rubber handle, which is important because you don't want to run into an electrical line and kill yourself. And it has a bullet on the end of a fiberglass shaft, so it's real easy to push into the ground. There's no dials. There's no gauges. You simply tell the moisture level by pushing it into the soil and by the feel. The other two probes, the second one, that one you have to buy, and it costs $20-something, not a lot of money, but you have to buy it. The other one you can get for free if you play golf, because you can use an old golf club and break the head off of a golf club. A driver's the best because the driver's the longest club. Or even better, saw it off at an angle with a hacksaw. And of course, golf clubs now have rubber handles, so you've got a rubber grip and you can use it as a probe, and it doesn't really cost you anything. Even people that don't play golf can go to a pawn shop and buy a golf club for 50 cents or a dollar. And then the final probe we use for our interior plants, and it's a pencil, a wooden pencil. And you use a sharpened wooden pencil, push the lead part in the soil, and the exposed wood, you know, will pick up particles of soil, you know, based on the moisture level. And you can tell very easily what the moisture is like down in the soil in a potted plant. Then let the soil dry out a little bit on the surface before you water again. And then as it's starting to dry out down under a few inches, you water again. You let the soil pulse. We do that outside. We do it in pots. We do it in containers inside. We want the air breathing into the air pores as the moisture goes away, and then being pushed out when the water goes in. That breathing or pulsing of the soil is very, very important.
Nice. I'm going to check out your website so I can see a little more of a visual thing. But
yeah, all great. This, there's great pictures of all this.
Answer and advice for listeners. Okay. How about a favorite internet resource? Is there somewhere you like to go on the web? I know listeners are definitely going to want to check out the dirtdoctor.com.
Well, dirtdoctor.com is loaded with information, very, very deep, and a lot of stuff you just kind of have to wade through it. The other one is texasorganicresearchcenter.org. Texas Organic Research Center is a not-for-profit, 501c3, and it's where all of the data is backing up everything we talk about. Data and research about the bad stuff, the things that we don't recommend, and also about the good things, the things that we do recommend. I think that the internet's full of great information. I think it's buyer beware. You've got to be a little bit careful wherever you're reading. And I think that people can get great information from a host of different websites. And then also make this commitment. Anytime somebody sees something on our website that they don't agree with, let us know. And if they see something that we haven't covered, let us know. And if they see something we haven't covered well enough, let us know. We're wanting to continue to improve and make it better and better and better. Our goal is very simple, and that is to convert the world to organics.
I really like that. You being a Marine and everything, it seems like that's a pretty ambitious goal and a pretty important mission that you're on now.
It is. Jackie, I'm going to have to run to a lunch deal. Is there anything else real quick you wanted to try to cover?
Well, can I ask my final question?
Sure.
Okay. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Well, I think the nonprofit that we're associated with is pretty high in importance, and having people contribute to it and help with it would be great, because it does not have, you know, a lot of resources and a lot of money. I think that if cities could do one thing that would be very simple to do to push everything this direction that we're talking about, they would make it illegal for homeowners to put on the curb leaves and bags and ground up tree trimmings and take those things to the landfill. They just simply stop doing that and force the homeowners to use that material on their own sites. It would be gigantic at moving things our direction. It would save tax money. It would improve the properties of all the people that had to keep that material and use it, you know, as mulch and compost. And of course, there need to be some setup for people that just, you know, couldn't do that, didn't have the resources to do it, or were handicapped or whatever. But for the most part, make it illegal for leaves, grass clippings, and tree trimmings to be sent to cities and go into the landfill, make them be used. Saves tax dollars for the people, makes the properties better, helps everybody across the board.
I love it. Awesome suggestion. Thank you so much. I just want to make sure. So the nonprofit, for everybody listening, is the Texas Organic Research Center. And you can go to their website, texasorganicresearchcenter.org. And
yes.
Then thank you, Howard. And your website is dirtdoctor.com. So have a wonderful day.
Jackie, I've enjoyed it. Thanks for helping spread the word.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow local.